time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the guilt.
Welcome back to the Cold War, episode 258.
Hell yeah.
My little Commando Oompa Loompa.
Thank you. I've been promoted. I am so excited. I'd like to thank so many people, but mostly myself and me.
No, that wasn't a title. It's just that I know that you're going Commando right now because you showed me before. They look, I'm going Commando. And I was shouldn't there be some genitalia there? You're like, I just...
I'm an Oompa Loompa. It's a mystery.
It's cold.
It's cold. It's
shrinkage, Jerry. It's shrinkage.
Oh, I saw the Seinfeld the other day about anti-dentite, and I just lost it all over again. Oh, my God. And soon they'll want their own schools. They do have their own schools, and Kramer's like, oh, you disgust me. Anyway, so don't be an anti-dentite, people. That's my advice.
You see that, speaking of Seinfeld adjunct news, Richard Lewis, Larry David's best friend, passed away, I think it was yesterday.
Yeah, I love Richard Lewis.
Our time.
Richard Lewis.
Yeah, Richard Lewis was so great on Curb Your Enthusiasm over the last 20 years.
Ball buster. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great sort of great performance for him, from him. And sad for all of us, but particularly for Larry to have lost a lifelong best friend.
I saw a quote that was so bad. It could have easily have been Larry David, but I haven't had a chance to check into it. It said something like, someone just told me my good friend Richard died. He's ruined my day, or he's made me very sad. I will never forgive him for that, or something like that. It's like, you fucking...
That was Larry. Larry said... Larry said, we were born in the same hospital a few days apart and I've known him my entire life, but today he made me sob and for that I'll never forgive him.
That's so Larry.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't imagine what you're going to say when I pass away. Yeah. Besides,
you want to be around for that, man. It's going to be...
I'm going to fake my death.
It's going to be gold.
So I can just hear it.
Oh, my God.
Here we go.
Again.
So So
you got out of your last two marriages, wasn't it?
Exactly. So Truman is against this. Acheson has been telling these people and telling the British, no, nothing's changed for us. You do not do this unless you want a world to hurt. But Foreign Secretary Morrison is going, I think I could change your mind. I don't think that's a big deal to them. I think I'm on to something.
You say he's against this, but you haven't explained is.
The military intervention into the refinery. I apologize. But Morrison really does think, one, the Americans aren't really that worked up about it. Two, I'm pretty sure I can change their mind. And three, what do I have to do to get Attlee to finally sign off on this? He is not going to stop in this episode or the next fucking episode.
Yeah, the UK Foreign Secretary, Herbert Morrison, as we said in the last episode, the British wanted to invade Iran in 1951, or from 1953 to 1951. Mm-hmm. The Americans trying to talk them out of it. Morrison tried to convince the Americans to support the invasion.
Right.
To avoid Britain looking feeble and ineffective at the hands of a man like Mossadegh, of whom he said, whose fanaticism bordered on the mental.
Oh. He's the fanatic. Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
He's the fanatic, not the British who want to fucking start a war to take control, to keep control of another country's oil assets. But Dean Acheson, Truman's Secretary of State, Acheson, wasn't it at the time? State?
Yeah.
Said no. Fucking... Mm. You're not going to do it. We're not going to let you do it. Right. Not going to happen.
Nothing's
Wouldn't
changed.
Be prudent at this juncture.
Juncture.
Not at this juncture.
Yeah.
But Morrison's not giving up easily.
He's dedicated. Yeah.
Yeah, like the good fascist that he was. Was he the fascist?
They're all fascists. You know, they're all pro-war. They're all pro-war. How's that? How's that? I think it's somebody else. I think that was one of the guys who came in and went, who was sent to Iran.
So Richard Stokes was the fascist.
But let's put it this way. Morrison has yet to find a war he hasn't liked. You know what I'm saying? He's ready. It's go time. It's go, go, go. He's ready.
Well, he decided that if the Americans won't let him invade, he's going to use covert methods to undermine the government of Moss the Boss.
That sounds right.
Using a combination of propaganda and destabilizing the country's economy and urging other elements to rise up. Now, I think this is, it's a really interesting example and the became the template how America's been overthrowing countries ever since.
They learned from the best.
Yeah. This is the post World War II way for major powers, and not just Western major powers. I'm sure the Soviet Union and Russia and China and I don't know anyone else you want to mention that had the wherewithal to do this.
Right.
Yeah. I've tried to use this template as well, but I don't think it's well understood by most people in the West.
Yeah. So sorry.
How this works.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to do gunboat diplomacy anymore. You don't need to put troops on the ground often. Right. There are times when you can get away with it. And countries love to get away with it if they can get away with it.
Oh, yeah.
I remind people that 6 months, no, I think it was a year before the 9/11 attacks.
Mm-hmm.
The PNAC report came out, Project for the New American Century,
right?
Written by an American think tank that had guys like Rumsfeld and Cheney on it. This is before George W. Bush was president,
right?
And they were part of his administration. They were part of this mostly Republican think tank, but there was some bipartisanship there.
Right.
They wrote this Project for the New American Century. You can look it up. It's online. It's been online for, 20-odd years. I read it not long after the 9/11 attacks. But one of the things that they talked about in this report, and again, this is before the 9/11 attacks, was that they needed to take greater control of the Middle East, particularly the oil assets in the Middle East, particularly Iraq's oil assets.
Mm-hmm.
But they complained in this report that the American public probably wouldn't support them putting boots on the ground in Iraq again. They'd done it in 1991 under Storm and Norman.
Yeah.
They felt that they had failed to capitalize on that. They should have left the troops there, and they didn't.
Right.
Daddy Bush couldn't get away with it.
Yeah.
And what they said in the PNAC report was, what we would really love, I'm paraphrasing, but what we would really love to do is to be able to put troops on the ground in Iraq and take control of the oil asset. Wouldn't it be great if we could put troops and keep them there for 20 years? But we won't be able to do that unless there was some sort of an attack on American interests or on American soil that we could somehow link to Iraq, right, and that would justify us in the public eye of putting troops in the ground.
Yeah.
6 months after this report came out, George Bush became president. 6 months after that, the 9/11 attacks happened, which they then used in 2003 to justify putting boots on the ground in Iraq. Now,
Jesus.
So my point is not that was a conspiracy, although it might have been, but that they will put boots on the ground if they can justify it.
Yeah.
If they can build a public justification act, but often they can't.
Yeah.
Or to do so would be too difficult. Like I'm sure they'd love to put American boots on the ground in Ukraine right now, but they know as soon as they do that, it's justification to Putin to ramp things up. And as Putin said in his speech just today, you know, nuclear options are not off the table.
Yeah.
If he needs to use nuclear to defend his country, then he will.
I'm looking at you, France. Yeah. So
yeah.
Yeah. Do what you got to do.
Thanks, Macron. And the Western media is having a field day accusing Putin of saber rattling. I'm like, well, why do we have fucking nuclear weapons in the first place? That's why every country has nuclear weapons, is to say there's a line, and if you cross it, we'll use them. That's why we have them. Right. It's not just Putin who's saying that. That's been the implied threat since 1945.
Since we have them
so we can use them.
Since you use them. Fucking use them twice.
Yeah.
Yeah. We will obliterate you and the line. Bitch. And before you go on, I just want to say the reason that Morrison's about to go more James Bonny as opposed to military, because I think it was in July 19th, Attlee said, look, you know what? I'm still not convinced. We'll send more warships. I get that, whatever. And eventually they're going to send more troops to Iraq, not Iran. But the point is like, I don't feel you, dog. I am not on the same page with you. And Morrison's like, okay, then let me do something else. And so Morrison is listening to his boss, but at the same time, he's kind of doing an end run around Attlee.
So this is the template for overthrowing governments of countries where you need to do it covertly.
Right, get a box.
So, a hole in the box. He turned to two scholars to help him develop a covert action plan. The first was a woman. Mm-hmm. Anne Lambton. She had been press attaché for the British Embassy in Tehran during World War II and had gone on to become one of Britain's leading scholars of Iran.
Wow.
And she started to develop effective lines of propaganda against Mossadegh. Now, by the way, I looked her up. Huge Christian, well-known.
They're the best.
In the UK during her.
Yeah.
During her life as being a huge Christian, she was ended up as Professor Emeritus of the Diocese of Newcastle and Chairman of the Iran Diocesan Association, served on the Middle East Committee and advised archbishops on interfaith matters. She delivered Lent lectures biannually to clergy and laity for many years. She was later awarded the Cross of St. Augustine in 2004 by the Archbishop of Canterbury in acknowledgement of her work and commitment to Christianity in the Church of England.
That's sweet.
So as a good Christian, she said, fuck yes, I'll help you overthrow the democratically elected government of Iran because they're sand monkeys and Muslims.
Yeah. So it's not like Morrison had to say something like, so if you were going to come up with some sayings or some slogans or some line of thoughts, not to attack the Shah, not to attack the Iranian people, just to attack Mossadegh, to get his own supporters to turn against him, what would you do and how much would it cost? And she goes, I got you, and this is for free. So she starts coming up with stuff, and I'm not going to jump ahead, but she's also the professor of Persian, and I think she did spend a lot of time in Tehran from 1953 to 1979. I wonder what happens in the late 70s and the early 80s that she's got to leave. But anyway, the point is she knows her shit, and Morrison has got a grade A1 source to give him excellent suggestions about how to chip away at Mossadegh's base.
Yeah, she, by the way, she lived until 96, died in 2008.
Damn, are we going to live this long?
She was.
These people are living a long time.
She was a professor at SOAS University of London, the School of Oriental and African Studies.
Wow.
She was like the professor of Persian at SOAS from 1953 to 1979.
Yeah.
But yeah, big expert on the region and a major Christian. And, you know, she's like, fuck yes, let's overthrow the government. Why the hell not? She asked, what would Jesus do?
Right.
And she came to the conclusion that he would come up with a covert propaganda campaign to overthrow the government.
Old blonde hair and blue eyes would overthrow them in a fucking second. Yeah.
Yeah, little known fact. Right. But one of the parables
right.
in the New Testament, you know, the famous parable about the olive tree that wouldn't bear fruit. And Jesus cursed it.
Right.
There's a fig tree, not an olive tree. The fig right. tree. He curses the fig tree and it withered and died. Really, that's a parable for using covert propaganda to overthrow the democratically elected government of countries that want to nationalize their assets.
That makes sense.
Not very well understood. You know, I am one of the world's leading experts
deep.
On you gotta go early deep. Christianity. I did a documentary. It took me like 4 years to fucking make, and then COVID came out just as it was supposed to be in cinemas. And
which was also God's will.
Was that 4 years of my life? Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah. That's what the parable of the fig tree was always about, overthrowing democratically elected governments. You can ask anyone. Any scholar of the New Testament studies will tell you that.
Right.
She also proposes to Morrison that he engage the services of Oxford University professor Robin Zahner, R.C. Zahner, and that he should go to Iran and begin covert operations. Now, Zahner was actually a veteran covert operative who had worked with the Special Intelligence Service in Iran, fluent in Persian, well acquainted with all of the leading figures of Iranian politics. Now, Zane is actually a genuinely interesting guy, British academic, expert in Eastern religions. He could read Sanskrit, Pali, and Arabic, so he could read a lot of the ancient sacred texts in their original language. Now, I've spent the last week or so reading the Upanishads, which I know, apart from R.C. Zane, you are one of the world's leading experts on the Upanishads. Right. Just explain to everybody what the Upanishads are.
I will. It depends on how much degree you want me to go to. I'm still mastering the ABCs, but as soon as I get to that, I will be on this like white on rice. But until then, why
that's in the U's. Oh. You have to get up to the U's for the Upanishads. Yeah. Should I just like
please,
you know? I don't.
Please take over.
I'll give them the dummies introduction. Right. You can come back and do the detail.
My thing. Brilliance.
You tell me if I get anything wrong
right.
here.
You can, right. I'll grade you. Let me get a piece of paper. Okay, go ahead.
The Upanishads are Indian mystical documents written somewhere between most of them. There's a lot of them, but they're written between 1500 BCE and sort of 800 BCE.
Wow.
And they sort of bridge the Vedas and Hinduism, but they mostly talk about enlightenment and non-duality, the oneness of all things, their instructions about their stories about people who, you know, thinking philosophically, what is the meaning of life? Who am I? What am I? And their right. teachers in these stories will explain to them about the oneness of all things and how everything is just, you know, the Brahman, which is the word they used for basically the universe,
right.
Consciousness, the universe, awareness, et cetera, et cetera. So really amazing documents like You know, my whole thing in Eastern philosophy has been my life since I was sort of 18 or 19. And you read these written 3,000, 3,500 years ago, and they're like, fucking on the money. Yeah. Like it's absolutely, you know, and completely aligned with modern physics.
Yes.
Without AI. Yeah. Completely aligned with modern physics and you know, quantum physics and, you know, wave theory, et cetera.
That's impressive.
Particle wave duality, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so this guy was an expert, R.C. Zahner, on all of these ancient religious documents, could read them in their original, in this case, Sanskrit.
Right.
His first writings at Oxford were on Zoroastrianism. all the texts of the Zoroastrian religion, mm-hmm. was deeply involved in exploring subjects like the mystical experience, comparative religion, translated the Bhagavad Gita, wrote a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita.
Good God.
He liked to take drugs in search of mystical experiences, good like Aldous Huxley.
Good
guy. He was the kind of guy that I would love to have actually sat down and had a drink with. Oh, by the way, he loved to drink, loved yes. his booze, loved taking yes. drugs. And of course, having spent a lifetime at this point studying the ancient religious texts from the Middle East, he also came to the conclusion that, sure, let's overthrow the government. Of right. the Middle East, of Iran.
Yeah.
If I've learned anything from my study of the Upanishads,
right.
the Buddhist texts,
yes.
You know, Zoroastrianism texts, it's that we should do everything we can to covertly overthrow the yeah. democratically elected government of Iran so we can steal their yeah. oil assets and keep all the money for ourselves. That was the only natural conclusion that right. you could come from being an expert on Middle Eastern religions and philosophies.
Yeah, and I lost count of the number of languages he speaks. So that was impressive. But also, there was a little bit of steel in this guy's spine. If you look at a picture of him, you're like, I could break you with one hand. I mean, the guy's a little whatever. But during World War II, he was out in the field, in the desert, in Iran, trying to help the trains run on time, supplies getting to the Soviet Union through Iran. So, there, you know, he was in the field. So not exactly spineless, but they don't need him killing people right now with a stiletto and a tactical turtleneck. What they need him doing is dropping little words here and there against Mossadegh, and because he's British, he's going to be listened to, and his words are going to be given weight. And so he just starts going around little poison pills against Mossadegh through the Iranian community around in Tehran.
And as I said before, this is basically the template.
Yes,
I think exactly. for how Western governments have learned to covertly overthrow foreign governments they dislike. Mm-hmm. So he gets sent to Tehran by Morrison as the acting counselor at the British ambassador's residence in Tehran.
Right.
He's at the embassy. He's an acting counselor. He's just a counselor. Look, I don't know what you're complaining about. He's just an acting counselor. Yeah. He's just like crossing T's and dotting I's overthrowing governments. I mean, it's nothing. Well, not a big deal.
When I'm not stamping passports, I overthrow occasionally. What else are you going to do?
Yeah, a little bit of overthrowing on the weekend, really. It's just a hobby. That's not – I actually get paid to do that. It's just what I do for shits and giggles.
And drugs. Lots of drugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
And the best drugs are in Persia, right? So you got to get it.
That's true.
His job was to meet with opposition figures and suggest ways they could undermine Mossadegh's government.
Yes.
With, of course, the financial and propaganda support
of
the United Kingdom all along the way. So he's the first outsider sent to Iran with the specific assignment of trying to subvert Mossadegh's government. He's the first. Yeah. He won't be the last.
No. He's a trailblazer. But yeah.
He's the guy. He's the point guy for trying to subvert the government.
Yes.
So we're going to encourage various forces across Iran to cause trouble for the Mossadegh government. Now, Mossadegh, as we know, is very, very well liked, very beloved by many people in Iran. But, of course, nobody has 100% support of a country.
Exactly.
You always have people that, you know, we've talked about this before, you know, the way Mossadegh became prime minister is, you know, he had his enemies and his critics and they challenged him, well, why don't you take the power if you're so fucking good? He's like, all right, I will, motherfucker. Yeah. So he's got enemies.
Yes.
And, you know, they're supporters of the Shah. They're supporters of more fundamentalist Islam because he's pretty secular in his approach to government. Exactly. There are people that do support the British.
Yeah.
There are people whose, you know, beaks have been wet by their involvement with the British or the Russians or the Soviets at this point. like, there's always people who aren't happy with the incumbent powers because they're missing. It's a bit like, you know, Julius Caesar, when he was dictator of Rome, even though he's, you know, forgiving his enemies and he's doing good things. As we know, there's always people that are bitching and moaning in the background about, well, why can't I be dictator? You know, there's always people that are ready to surround you and stab you 26 times if they think there's something in it for them.
Exactly.
If they're going to be better off
with you
under a new regime, then, yeah, they're thinking, you know, with their pocketbooks, thinking with their wallets. So his job was to find those people and incentivize them to cause problems. Now, while he's doing that, the British government are doing other things.
Yeah. And just real quick, Zahner is so good at what he's doing, he actually gives Mossadegh's opponents hope. Who else does he give hope to? He gives hope to the people back in London, in the Foreign Office, like, oh my God, this could actually work. So as Kev was saying, so they're stepping up their military steps to frighten the Iranian people. They've started now a covert campaign, and they've already been hurting the economy of Iran. And again, that's what you do. You make it so bad for the people there. They're like, you've got to change something. You've got to give in. You've got to acquiesce. You have to do something because I can't go on and live this way. But as we said before, there's something about, and I'm sure, Cam, you know this a lot better than I do. There's something about the Shiite religious tradition. They're okay with suffering, with struggling, and they've been doing without for over a century. And so for them, even though things are pretty bad, for those who still support Mossadegh, they're like, we can do this all day. What else do you got? So we're about to find out, because the British are like, okay, there are other things we can do, and we will keep trying until we get what we want.
So they're going to now, on top of trying to covertly encourage the overthrow of Mossadegh's government, the British are going to set out to try and cripple the Iranian economy.
Yes.
And if you combine crippling a country's economy with creating a disinformation campaign and incentivizing and encourage internal elements that, you know, want to overthrow the government, you can have a devastating effect on the political climate in any country.
Yeah.
So one of the steps that they took was to sabotage the Abadan refinery.
Right.
Eric Drake, the general manager at Abadan when it was nationalized, reported years later,
of course,
that British managers did all they could to assure that the machines didn't work and that the new managers, the Iranian managers, wouldn't be able to find out how the place was run.
Right.
Now, that would have been fine, maybe, if the Iranians could hire technicians to fix the machines that the British were sabotaging. And they tried. They placed advertisements in European newspapers and in industry journals trying to hire technicians. But British diplomats made sure that nobody would accept the job. They persuaded Sweden, Austria, France, and Switzerland to deny exit visas to anyone who wanted to apply for the job. Sure, Jesus. You can take the job, but we won't let you leave the country.
Exactly, yeah. And in Germany, which was, of course, still under Allied occupation, so the British have a lot more sway there, they asked the government in Germany to refuse the grants of passports to German nationals intending to travel to Persia. So do you remember a couple of episodes where we said, and we said it several times, the British would not allow any Iranians to learn the technical aspects of their job? Well, now the Iranians desperately need someone who knows what they're doing around these machines. Not only do they not have anybody, now they can't get anybody. So now the Americans are going to get involved because, again, they don't want a war. They just want this handled. They want this resolved. So they're going to try to help Iran get the workers they need.
Not the American government, though.
No, sorry.
American firms.
Exactly.
An American firm publicly offered the Iranian government help to recruit 2,500 American technicians
we'll do it.
To run the oil industry.
Yeah.
But then the U.S. State Department told them they couldn't do it, that it was contrary to British interests and embarrassing to the United States.
Yeah.
An American congressman called Owen Harris, a relative of yours, I assume.
Not if he had money. No. probably one of the legitimate Harrisons. I'm a, well, you know that story. I'm Native American, so we don't count. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Introduced a bill which authorized the Secretary of the Interior to look for qualified experts and help them travel to Iran. But British diplomats complained and it got killed by the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Yeah, but it's okay.
In Britain, 20 Anglo-Iranian employees who had left Iran wanted to return to help out, were told by the British government that under the new sanctions that they'd put in place against Iran, these guys would be allowed, would not be allowed to convert their salaries into British currency. You can go.
All you want, go. Yeah. But
you won't be able to do anything with your money that you get paid.
Can't bring it back here because you can't convert it to pounds. So not unexpectedly, all of this is actually working. Things are getting bad. Things are getting tense. But again, and this is, to me, this shows Britain's mentality almost more than anything else. Even though the British campaign, just short of military intervention, is working, they're still like, you know, I don't know, Mossadegh's pretty crafty, he's pretty clever. They still might figure out a way. So we've got to do more. And you have to stop for a second and go, well, if London's got that mentality, then they're capable of doing anything. But at this point, between the British and the Americans, those companies own about 2/3 of the world's oil tankers. But Soviet Union's got their own oil tankers. Other countries have their own oil tankers. So London doesn't have a lock on it like they wish they could. So so London, and when I say London, I mean, of course, the Foreign Office, considers intercepting on the high seas foreign tankers that have come from Persia. But then someone went, hey, that sounds like, is that piracy? I think that's piracy. We used to fight against that. Not pipsqueaks, but piracy. So they're like, I think they might be going, how do you say, Reginald, a bit too far. So they have to back down. But it was a good idea. But it shows how, not desperate, but it shows how serious they were in their intent.
So when they figured out that piracy was probably something they might struggle to get away with.
Precocious for right now. Yeah. Premature.
Anglo-Iranian placed advertisements in newspapers around the world warning that it would take all such actions as may be necessary against any country that bought oil from Iran.
Is that an embargo? Is that a fucking embargo by one country over another? Or am I reading? Is it just a threat? That's just a fucking threat.
Well, yeah, it is. It's just an implied threat. If you buy oil from Iran, there will be penalties.
There will be consequences.
You're not going to say what.
That's right. He picked up the gun. Yeah, yeah.
Well, this is the same thing that particularly the United States does today, right? Economic sanctions against countries, which basically says to all the other countries in the world, you're not allowed to buy stuff from country X because we don't like what they're doing. You can't. So on one hand, we believe in free trade.
Freedom.
Just not with the people that we don't like.
On this
if
list,
you trade with them, fuck you.
That's right.
We're coming for you. We will take, there will be consequences if you trade with the countries that we, where we don't believe in free trade.
Right.
We believe in free trade when it's in our interests.
To a point.
When it's not in our interests, then fuck free trade. Fuck you for suggesting it. So they're just making vague threats to scare customers off of supporting it. Despite all of that, though, in the summer of 1951, a couple of American oil companies offered to supply their own tankers to the Iranian oil company if they would sell them 10 million tons of crude oil over the next year.
Now we're talking.
But one of the British workers still at Aberdeen, a general manager at Aberdeen, it might have been Eric Drake, found a way to intercept telegrams being sent to the National Iranian Oil Company. He told his superiors in London about the American offer. The British then appealed to the US State Department, who told the companies they needed to withdraw their offer. So we believe in capitalism and the freedom to do business, unless we don't, in which case you can't fucking do it.
I've got to imagine that Dean Acheson at this point is like, I can't believe I worked so hard to try to get this job. I just want to shoot myself in the face right now. He's getting, every time an American or anybody else does anything, London calls him, bitches at him, and then he's got to tell the State Department to tell them to back down. I mean, this is happening again and again and again, and he's still getting the sense that the British don't understand truly how much the president is like, there had better not be a fucking war. So he truly is in the middle of all of this, and he's probably just doing the best he can.
And there were offers from companies in Italy and Portugal, again, as soon as the British found out about it, because they were hacking the telegrams to National Iranian Oil Company. They used diplomatic pressure to have them shut down. Iran then tried to arrange deals with India and Turkey, but the British intervened and stopped those as well. Damn. So you've got a combination of economic warfare against Iran, plus covert operations that are trying to disrupt the government, and things are starting to come to a head. There are debates in the Majlis, and there are complaints in the Iranian media, most of which are, again, funded by the British to cause trouble for Mossadegh. U.S. Ambassador Grady then warned in interviews with newspapers in Iran that either war with the British or a communist takeover might be imminent. And those were his last words as ambassador. Acheson decided that he'd become a liability.
You gotta go. You gotta go. Sorry.
And replaced him with a guy called Loy Henderson.
Yes.
Loy. Mm-hmm. What kind of a fucking name is Loy Henderson? L-O-Y. He was a good old Cold War warrior.
Yes.
Who declared that Mossadegh was a madman who would ally himself with the Russians.
Yeah.
Now,
so, neutral?
How much do you know about Loy Henderson?
I do know that he does have a ton of experience. In 1933, when Roosevelt, recognized the Soviet Union, Henderson went there with the U.S. Embassy. He was there in 1935. He stayed there when Bullitt left after Bullitt got pissed at Stalin. So he's got some experience. But the point is, he's got this mentality because of his experiences, like we all do, where he really sees an East versus the West kind of mentality. So he either talks to Mossadegh or he hears stuff about Mossadegh, and he just assumes, this is my official position. This guy's a madman, and he's willing to work with the Russians, which almost makes me want to ask, are you saying he's mad because he wants to work with the Russians? The point is, Henderson is not neutral going into this. What have you got?
Yeah, like, he was a guy, he was with George Kennan and Charles Bolin in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in the 30s. But unlike them, developed a massive hatred for the Russians and sort of became a bit of a liability during the Roosevelt administration. He was sort of totally against them treating the Soviets as an ally in 1942. And he ended up getting removed from that position. They sent him to Baghdad to be the U.S. ambassador in Iraq. So he's got some Middle East experience. He's also the ambassador to India, 1948 to 51, and then the ambassador to Iran, as I said, from 51 to 54. He really, really has a pathological hate for the Soviets and the Russians.
He can't think straight.
He goes on to be involved in the 1953 CIA coup against Mossadegh, as we will see, of course, because he's the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador there. After Truman's gone and the Eisenhower administration comes in and decides that via the CIA that they will get involved after all. Anyway, the British then decide to take their case to the United Nations Security Council. They're well, we set this fucking thing up. We're going to stand up and give a big speech in the Security Council to say we should be able to invade a country just because we want their oil. Exactly. Sure, that'll work. That's a good plan.
Well, actually, former Ambassador Grady, the guy who was kicked out, the American, told a London newspaper, and I love this. He says something along the lines of, look, I get what you're doing. You're going to go to the United Nations so you can tell your side of the story. Well, guess what, bitch? If you get to tell your side of the story, doesn't that mean the Iranians get to tell their side of the story? They get to mention it's their oil. They've been oppressed for over 100 years, that Western capitalism is fucking them up, and they're going to fuck up all the other small countries that can't defend themselves. So you can give your speech, but then some Iranian is going to give their speech, and you ain't going to like it. One coin, two sides. So, and he's not wrong. He's not wrong.
So Dean Acheson also, you know, thought it was pointless because the Soviets are probably just going to use their veto in the Security Council to veto it anyway.
And
he sends
good.
A note.
Yeah.
He sends a note via his UK ambassador to Foreign Minister Morrison, basically saying that forcing a United Nations debate might lead to an irrevocable freezing of the Iranian situation.
Yeah.
Morrison is pissed.
Yes.
When the U.S. ambassador comes to give him this note. Yeah.
You know, keep in mind, hold on just real quick, before Cam reads this, keep in mind that Morrison has not read the note yet from Acheson. He's just got the note in his fucking hand. He's just reacting to the American who's in his office. I'm sorry, Cam. I had to stress that because that makes it even better.
Even before he reads the note, he's just fucking furious that the Americans are getting involved.
Again.
He says to the U.S. ambassador that we have been the saints and Mossadegh has been the naughty boy. Like, just pause for a moment and think about the levels of batshit insanity in the U.K. government at the time. Like,
we've been even good.
Yeah. After, like, if he said, you know what, we're being a pack of cunts, but hey, fuck it. You know,
but we need the oil.
Yeah, I'll fucking do it. We need the oil.
Be honest.
Okay, be honest. Yeah, I'd have like, this is to the U.S. ambassador, not to, you know, what you tell the electorate, what you tell the media, fine, you're going to bullshit to them. But to the U.S. ambassador, go, listen, you know, motherfucker, we need the oil. You know we need the oil. We know you know we need the oil. Stop fucking cock blocking us. Let us get the oil, right? We're fucked if we don't have this oil, right? But no, he goes on this rant about we have been saints. Like, seriously? Like,
saint
fuck
what?
This.
Saint
God,
asshole?
I hate these cunts. Seriously? Yeah.
Patron saint of penis?
He was, and he was sure that the UK's UN representative, Sir Gladwin Jebb, there's a fucking name. Actually, Hubert Miles Gladwin Jebb, the first Baron Gladwin.
That's great.
He was sure that Gladwin would dominate the UN debate. By the way, this guy was serving as the acting Secretary General of the United Nations between 1945 and 1946.
Ooh.
I'm thinking, has this guy never heard of Mossadegh before? Mossadegh is the greatest orator that Iran has produced in 500 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Giving a speech in the United Nations against Britain and the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Like, right. Mossadegh used to jerk off at night just dreaming about having the opportunity to do this one day. And he's in his late 70s. Like, you don't want to think of a guy in his late 70s jerking off, but come on, man. Like, this was like his absolute porno fantasy come true. Right. This guy's creating an opportunity for Mossadegh to do that. Is he insane?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure, because maybe I read this a little different. I interpreted it a little different. I'm not sure if the British thought, well, Mossadegh's not going to come himself, right? I mean, this is the United Nations. He's got a representative here. Surely he'll pick someone else. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Mossadegh can sell used cars to a used car salesman. He's that good. He's that persuasive. He's been reading books for years. He's got a command of the language. He can just lay it out there. And they think, and if you think about it, for let's say for a second he was really bad at speaking, his argument is flawless. David and Goliath, the rich against the poor, the oppressors against the oppressed. What was World War II all about? Forget his beautiful flowery language for a second. If he just said something along those lines, and all those other countries that look to Iran to be inspired to stand up to the British, they would get worked up too. I mean, this, like you said, wet fucking dream for Mossadegh.
Like, and of course, as we'll see in the next episode, Mossadegh is not only going to go and speak at the United Nations, he's going to go on a tour of the U.S., building even – like, this is giving him an excuse
to travel.
To go and go and build further support in the U.S. for the plight of the poor Iranians, right. Which, of course, won't last very long in the U.S. once the propaganda machine gets into play over there. But so, yeah, like he's going to go to the United Nations, and it's not just going to be a speech about one small nation against a large company, but
right.
a speech telling the story of some of the poorest people on earth going up against one of the richest and most powerful colonial powers. It's a David and Goliath story that he's going to go and sell to the world. And these idiots in the UK
arrogant.
Are basically, he's arrogant. Like, don't throw me into the briar patch, Brer Fox.
No anything.
Please,
but that.
Brer Fox.
Yes.
Don't throw me into the briar patch.
And I think his tour is going to be called the Freedom Loving People's Tour of America. Something. I have to look it up. Something like that.
We'll get into that next time. That is all for today.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent.